Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast. In this episode, we discuss the impact that VAR is having on the sport of soccer, CBS's big addition and big loss to their coverage of the UEFA Champions League that begins this week, our recommended games to watch midweek, and of course, the letters from you, the listeners. My name is Christopher Harris. I'm joined by my co-host, Kartik Krishnire. How was your weekend and how was your soccer watching?
Yeah, I suppose the soccer watching was all impacted by VAR, which we've said previously the Bundesliga is a league that may be less compelling now than the Premier League, but they don't have these bad VAR decisions in the Bundesliga. So I found myself, as the weekend kind of dragged on, starting with the Dortmund game Friday, gravitating a little bit back to the Bundesliga because the thing about watching the Premier League as a neutral, but as a neutral who tends to support, I'm a Manchester City supporter, and obviously they've been at the very top of the league the last few years, but beyond that, tends to support the underdog, is that it feels like VAR is not equitable. And I would include Man City in this, right? Man City got a horrifically unfair VAR decision in their favor last year against Everton, which almost relegated Everton. You could say handed the title to Manchester City, but I think there were some decisions that went Liverpool's way through the course of the season as well. And then this weekend, I think what you saw was VAR generally favoring the bigger sides. And that's something that bothers me. I mean, it bothered me the first year VAR was in, where it seemed like the teams that were getting hurt the most by VAR were Wolves and Sheffield United, who were recently promoted teams from the Championship who were punching above their weight. And it seemed like they were on, and this could all be coincidence, but I don't know. We're now 4 years into VAR in the Premier League, and it's, I know we should be talking about the actual matches, but VAR for me is the overriding factor of this weekend, overriding takeaway.
So it does favor the big teams, so it seems, but also the big teams have oftentimes the biggest crowds. So I just wonder, in terms of being at Stamford Bridge and with the fans as loud as they are, whether it's Old Trafford or Stamford Bridge or the Etihad or other stadiums, whether that crowd noise and that level of ferocity from the fans, if it does have an influence on the referees. Of course, I think in many ways, if Christina Uncle, the referee expert, was on the phone with us right here, she'd say, no, it wouldn't have an impact. These are impartial referees. They have played and refereed in the biggest stadiums in the world. They know the pressure. But subconsciously, it must have an impact, I would imagine. Kartik, do you agree?
Oh, it absolutely has an impact. That's my entire theory, is that because you're adding a second level of subjectivity, which is subjective, the VAR interpretation. And I even think it's subjective when they draw the lines on offsides, because I want to go back and look at the offside call against Connor Cody for Everton. I believe that when the ball is played, he is behind the ball, even if he's ahead of the Liverpool defenders. But I feel like the freeze frame they used was after the ball was released and moving diagonally backwards, or diagonally to whatever direction from the foot of Neil Maupay towards Connor Cody. So I mean, even in those cases, there's a subjectivity involved. And it seems to always, I don't want to say always, but it seems to more often than not favor the Liverpools and the Man Cities and the Chelseas and the Manchester United. And it just leaves kind of a sour taste in my mouth. And on the Cornet goal that was disallowed, I mean, come on. I think that was ultimately impacted by the Bridge crowd or by some sort of momentum in the match or whatever it was. It doesn't seem like these calls are not being made letter of the law. So what I had been sold on with VAR, I had been opposed to it, and then I flipped as it was implemented because I had been convinced by referees that, oh, it's going to be letter of the law. It's going to be very, very objective. The VAR official is going to be cast aside in another place, all of which is true, and that this will allow the crowd and the factors in the match that may influence a poor decision or the quick pace of play, which may create a bad decision or a wrong decision. This will correct that. Well, in fact, all it's done is added another layer of that, in my opinion. You know, it's made the match worse. It's made the game worse.
Yeah, that's my biggest takeaway from this is it's, and this is not a new topic, right? This is something, like you said, we've been talking about for 4 years now with VAR in the Premier League. But to me, whether it's the Premier League or MLS or Bundesliga or Serie A or any league around the world that uses VAR, and not every league uses VAR, but what for me happens oftentimes is it takes the fun out of the game. It takes the excitement out of the game. And we saw that too. I mean, the Brighton game, with Alexis McAllister scoring the goal of the season. And we thought it was a fantastic goal. The crowd goes wild, the player celebrates, and then it goes to VAR. And then it's, okay, a lot of scrutiny, very tedious. Okay, was that player offside or not? And by the smallest of hairs, he was offside. And by the letter of the law, the correct decision was made and the goal was ruled off. But, Kartik, I'm going to have to call you on this one, though. In the past, several times, you've said, well, these things balance out over the course of a season, right?
Yeah, they do. And it already has for Chelsea, because Chelsea fans were going crazy after the Spurs match, right? They were complaining like mad that there was some sort of conspiracy against Chelsea. And who was it? Was it Michael Oliver? Who was the official that day? Or was it Anthony Taylor? I think it was Anthony Taylor. Anthony Taylor should never officiate at the Bridge again. He should never be allowed to a Chelsea match again. 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, how many weeks it's been since that Spurs match, they clearly stole 3 points, lack of a better term, even though you could argue 2 points were stolen from them in the Spurs match. So this stuff all balances out. I believe it does balance out over 38 matches. Where it doesn't balance out is when you have calls like this in cup competitions, which through the years, it feels like Barcelona and Real Madrid have benefited more from botch calls in UEFA competitions than other sides. And I even remember a two-leg tie between Juventus and Real Madrid where there were all kinds of strange calls, all went in Real's favor. Bayern and Real Madrid, same thing. They all went in Real's favor. Barca and Chelsea, we know about that story. Barca, Arsenal. So I think over a league campaign, it does all even out, but it takes those moments away from fans. The cauldron that is Goodison exploding when Mope plays that ball across to Cody, which, again, I still believe is off onside. I might have to go back and find some freeze frames or do freeze frames myself because I think he was behind the ball. I'm convinced of that. I know he was. I know the last Liverpool defender he was ahead of, but that's immaterial, actually, remember, with offside. But it's taking those moments away. It's taking the moment away on the McAllister goal at Brighton. It's taking the moment away for the West Ham traveling fans at the Bridge. And we know what an intense derby that is. We know what an intense grudge match that is. And that's now my biggest complaint. Even as a fan watching at home, when Cody scored that goal, I have a soft spot for Everton. I think everybody now realizes that, particularly when they play in this Merseyside derby. The excitement, the sheer joy I got from that goal in the 71st minute, I believe it was, putting them ahead in a Merseyside derby, which is not a position Everton has been in at Goodison in the last I think they last won a Merseyside derby in Goodison days after Fenway Sports Group bought Liverpool. So that was in November of 2010. To take that moment away is just it's really harsh. And I know that people say, well, you're getting the VAR defenders say that you're getting the right calls now and it's a more fair and just game. The sport is always filled with inequities and inequalities. It wasn't meant to be fair results wise. And I maintain, even without VAR, officiating decisions tend to even out over 38 matches. So if you have VAR, they tend to even out. If you don't have VAR, they tend to even out, and you tend to get the best champions. The right teams get relegated. I mean, I think there was one exception, which was the year Sheffield United was relegated under Neil Warnock. I think they got really some bad luck with officiating, and then obviously the Tevez situation with West Ham. But generally, these things even out, and adding VAR has just added more outrage and complication and anger to the pot.
Yeah, you also had, of course, Martinelli with that wonderful goal at Old Trafford for Arsenal, which was called back.
Yeah.
I think rightly so in this one, where the foul earlier, Martin Odegaard kind of been pushing and kind of lower contact on that one. But also you had Newcastle United that had a goal that was disallowed due to VAR. And in both the instances with the West Ham United equaliser, which was chalked off, disallowed, and then the Newcastle United winner that was also disallowed, the PGMOL, which is the refereeing body in England, has come out to say that mistakes were made in terms of the way that VAR was used. So West Ham definitely will feel, really kind of tough there in terms of, they could have had, that would have been an equaliser, that would have been one point at Stamford Bridge, that's huge. They walk away with a loss. Newcastle United, that could have been a victory there against Crystal Palace. Instead, that's a draw, and you've lost 2 points there too. I think, again, at the end of the day, for me, the VAR thing is just, it's taking the excitement out of the game. Because when you see great goals, or any goals, you celebrate. But now you're almost holding back because you're like, oh, I don't want to celebrate too much just in case this is ruled off. The other thing interesting, Kartik, this week is that UEFA, for the group stage of the UEFA Champions League, is going to be using the automated offside technology, which has been used in the last year or two in different women's soccer competitions, as well as some other tournaments, I believe. And this, we go back to kind of, that moment in the Everton match where you said that the freeze frame was at the wrong moment. Maybe this will resolve those things where instead of, I'm sure there's humans still involved in the process, but there will be automated technology that will say, okay, here's when the ball was kicked, and here's when the player, in that particular moment in time, if that player was onside or offside. I still think at the end of the day that the offside rule needs to be changed, because we're getting into a situation, and this has been going on for a few years now, where it is so, the margins are so small that you can be off by a couple of inches and it's ruled offside. To me, I think there should be clear daylight, and if you see clear daylight between the attacker and the defender, then that should be offside. But if it's so close to the human eye, and even with the VAR, sometimes these VAR things go on for quite a couple of minutes, where replay, looking at it again, analyzing it, is it off or not? And it's so hard to tell, even with technology. So maybe the automated thing will help us, but we'll find out probably. And it might take a while. It might take a couple of weeks to find out whether this is working or not.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think it can work any worse, truthfully. So it'd probably be an improvement. And to your point about daylight, I absolutely agree. This that used to be the standard referees used. Okay, so you had these very the lines being drawn and the knee lunging forward and that being a playable part of the body, so that being offside. That was never really considered by most top referees until very recently. The other thing is about the standard about back passes and touches by the defenders. So going back, I know I'm obsessing on one VAR call, but going back to the Cody goal that was disallowed, even if Mope and the ball were behind Cody, which I don't think is accurate, as I've already said. I believe Milner had a touch. That the ball may have touched off of Milner's boot, whether he intended to play it or not. So maybe it didn't. So, but if it did, then I think that that shouldn't be offside. But I know now the standard is if the defender intended to play the ball. Well, if a guy didn't intend to deflect a ball into the back of the net, a defender, then maybe that shouldn't count. That shouldn't be a goal. By the same standard, right? All these shots that take wild deflections off defenders but are shots on target and then the keeper's wrong-footed, I think it's ridiculous. If a defender touches a ball, then I think it's a live ball and their offside should not apply. I don't care whether it was intentional or not. So the offside rule needs to be re-examined. And the other thing, Chris, is that they constantly tweak the offside rule, right? There are changes in directives every season in the Premier League or the Bundesliga or Serie A, wherever, that affect how fans and supporters and consumers view the sport, because we're used to one standard one season and then it changes the next, even if the law hasn't been rewritten. Certain points of emphasis are given to the officials. And I think that this is complicating a very simple game, to be honest.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the thinking originally was that technology would benefit these decisions. I mean, the goal line technology to me is perfect. It doesn't work 100% of the time. There's been instances where it hasn't worked, but 99.9% of the time, goal line technology works, and that's simpler. That's more objective. I think the technology is complicating things, and to me, it is diminishing the actual end product, which is like for this podcast, Kartik, every week we want to talk about all the great things that happened, what wonderful match we watched, whether it was a comeback, Montreal coming back and beating Toronto, or what the Inter Milan Milan derby, whatever it may be. And of course we saw those games and we saw a lot of great goals and action, but instead we're talking about VAR and I don't want it to be that way. It has to be talked about because it is having such an impact, and to me a negative impact on the game. Yes, it's making some right decisions, but it's not helping with the enjoyment and kind of flow of the game, because it's stop, start, going back and just micro-analyzing situations. It's taking the fun out.
Yeah, and quite frankly, this weekend, maybe I'm a sourpuss, and if you feel that way, we have the listener mailbag. You can come back at me or at us for it, but it's obscured the entire weekend for me, at least in England, at least in the Premier League. And maybe this is me, my own psychology, which is I need to work on, but I've gotten kind of depressed about some of these VAR calls and the way some of these results went as a result. I mean, particularly Everton and West Ham, to where and Newcastle to a lesser extent, to where I'm thinking, this is just it raises your blood pressure. It leaves you feeling angry for a period of time that then extends into the next match window. It really dampers the enjoyment of the sport. And the McAllister goal, same thing. It had me upset, although I guess Brighton still won and still won going away. But it's just it has added another layer, not only of subjectivity among officials, but another layer of controversy that obscures the actual matches. So you're different than me, Chris. You were focused on the football these last few weeks. I was so exhausted by Thursday night. I basically wanted to sleep all day Friday, and then I watched the Dortmund match and the Burnley West Brom match in the afternoon. But I was so exhausted by transfers, and this whole the last few days I don't remember a transfer deadline day being this hectic with so many late moves in a window that was already an extended window. So real craziness Wednesday and Thursday. And then to go from the transfers to saying, okay, we're finally going to settle down and watch football. We know what the squads are now. And then this is the first weekend as a result. But the good news is, honestly, in Italy, which I watched a little of this weekend, in Germany, which I watched more than I have all season, they don't have these problems. And they have VAR there. So it may not be VAR. It might be the way the Premier League does VAR, which I think we've said before on this show.
Yeah, and that's the thing too about the Bundesliga. You mentioned earlier that you kind of watched a little bit more Bundesliga this past weekend than previous weekends. I think that Friday game has a big impact. It's one of those things, it's almost like an appetizer. The Premier League doesn't do a lot of Friday games, but when it does, it kind of, I mean, usually I gravitate to that Premier League match on a Friday, and then that leads me into the weekend and gets me hooked on that one, and then I'm watching the Saturday morning one, and so on and so forth. And I think with the Bundesliga, even though that Friday viewing number, I'm sure, and we've seen this in previous years, the Friday viewing number isn't significantly large, it does hook your attention, and it grabs you in terms of the storylines, and then you're more likely to watch on the Saturday. However, Kartik, I don't know if you saw this, though, this past Saturday, Union Berlin against Bayern Munich, a massive game, right? Top of the table clash, top three clash. And ESPN Plus had some major issues. I think for the first like half hour, basically, it wasn't working. And then it would work, and then it would stop, and then it would work on some devices, but not other devices. But unfortunately, I mean, that's the only option, right? When you're on a streaming service where all the games are on streaming and that's it, and it's not working, and it's a big game. By the time it came back, when I got it, it was already missed two goals. It was already, I think, 1-1 to both sides.
Yeah, we missed both goals in the match, and that's a classic example, right? Because I'm frustrated by the way Everton-Liverpool has finished. Also, quite frankly, I think Van Dijk should have been sent off for his studs-up challenge on Anona, and if it were the other way around, Liverpool fans would be flooding Twitter saying, Everton players are always trying to hurt Liverpool players, and Everton are a dirty team, and they made this allegation for years. When the shoe's on the other foot, Everton fans aren't saying the same thing. But anyway, VAR missed that also. So I was really kind of angry after that match, even though I know the draw is a good result for Everton. And I think Lampard, the things I had said about Lampard, where I'm very patient and think that things will come together, they're coming together, even though they're not getting wins yet. They need to start getting some 3 points soon. But I'm happy with the progression, but I really feel like they should have gotten 3 points out of that match. So I flipped to the Bundesliga, to Hulu, and it's not working. And I don't think my Hulu stream came up until 9:50 or so Eastern time, which time both goals in the match had been scored.
So Leeds United, Kartik, what a roller coaster of a ride this season's going to be. I mean, we knew this, right? We knew there would be highs, we knew there'd be lows. And this past weekend against Brentford, I think it really exposed this Leeds United team.
Yeah, I think they have. So this is the issue ultimately with Marsh teams. We saw it with Ranić last season. So for those who aren't as familiar with Marsh's coaching philosophy, what you saw from Ranić at Manchester United, it's generally the same philosophy. I think it works better with the guys Marsh has, and he's had a window to sign guys, right, that fit the system, unlike Ranić at Man United, who was a caretaker and wasn't able to get the right personnel in. But you will see a lot of matches where they suffocate the opposition with their high press and creating mistakes as teams play out of the back. We saw that against Chelsea, right? And then you will see other matches where they're just opened up like this by teams that are similarly athletic and similarly built to press high, create mistakes, force the tempo of the match. So Brentford is a bad matchup for them, which I felt last season too, and they got the result in that last match of the season to keep them up against a Brentford team that admittedly had nothing to play for other than maybe finishing a spot or two higher in the table. But I think this will be Leeds all season. I didn't jump on the bandwagon of saying, oh, now they're definitely safe, they're going to finish in the top half like others. Now I'm not jumping on the bandwagon that, oh, they're definitely going down. I think this season is really complicated from multiple perspectives as to why it's difficult to see who clearly is going down and who's going to get cut adrift at this point. In addition to the World Cup, the extended transfer window and the amount of transfer activity at the end of the transfer window is pretty pretty glaring. And Leeds, of course, didn't get their number one target, right? He ends up going to – well, he didn't end up going to Nice, right? He failed his physical at Nice. So they let Dan James go to Fulham under the pretense, I think, that they were getting another – player, another physical kind of or athletic type player that didn't pan out. So I don't think they're undermanned, but it's going to be a topsy-turvy season for them. The other side, I'd say, is going to be like that of Southampton, who are going to be very up and down all season because of their youth.
Yep. All right, let's move on to TV streaming news. Kartik, I'll kick this one off. So big news this past week, and that is that CBS Sports announced their talent, both their commentators and studio talent, for the UEFA Champions League and also Europa League coverage, and of course Conference League too. A lot of familiar faces are returning. Of course, Kate Abdo, Jamie Carragher, Thierry Henry, etc., Mika Richards, I believe, too. So that hasn't changed there. But the big change is on the commentary side. And in the past few weeks, too, we had quite a few people asking us, hey, what's happening with Peter Drury? Is he coming back? Because Peter Drury is now a full-time employee of NBC Sports, calling the games for the Premier League exclusively for the United States audience. And we found out the answer to that, and that is that Peter Drury has an exclusive contract with NBC Sports, and he will not be doing the UEFA Champions League commentaries this season or Europa League for – well, actually, the Champions League for CBS Sports. Clive Tildsley will remain the number one lead commentator for UEFA Champions League. And but Peter Drury is a big loss. Replacing Peter Drury is Dre Cordero, who many of you will know from commentating a lot of Serie A games for CBS Sports and Paramount Plus, previously at beIN Sports, as well as calling a lot of the CONCACAF Nations League and games involving the U.S. men's national team for CBS Sports and Paramount Plus. And the other addition to CBS Sports is the one and only Ray Hudson. And Ray Hudson is joining CBS Sports, and he will be alongside Dre Cordero. The two of them have worked together quite a lot, into Miami games also, but also mostly at beIN Sports, working together on commentaries. Kartik, what was your reaction to hearing the news that Peter Drury is no longer there, but replaced by Ray Hudson and of course, Dre Cordero?
I think it's great that Ray Hudson is coming into CBS's Champions League coverage, and particularly when it comes to covering Spanish teams. He has an incredible amount of experience and is the one and only kind of co-commentator voice in the English language for it. I'm a little disappointed, and obviously I'm partial to Ray Hudson as a someone who was a ball boy during his playing career with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers and continued to work with the Strikers organization on and off in its various incarnations after that. I was a little disappointed CBS didn't make a bigger deal of this, and I think maybe it's generational. Maybe the generation that CBS has targeted with Champions League coverage is less familiar with Ray Hudson and Ray Hudson's calls, or they might be more Premier League centric, right? So they don't know, they haven't watched him on Gold TV and beIN through the years. So that was a little disappointing, but that's just on the media side. They went out and got the guy that really will enhance their coverage. So kudos to CBS Sports and their production team and their talent acquisition team. Maybe a little bit of a lesson to their media side, media comms side, that this is a pretty big deal for a lot of people in the sport in this country. Great hire.
Yeah, me personally too. I'm a big Ray Hudson fan, but again too, you and I know him very well. We've grown up with him. We've seen him play. We've seen him coach. We've interviewed him many times, and he's a genuine, really, really nice guy. But he has a shtick. His shtick, magisterial in terms of his commentary style, which I think in some ways is unfair, though, because there is a lot of heart and soul that goes into his commentary. He really lives the game, and not everyone likes Ray Hudson by any means. There's a lot of people that dislike his commentary style or co-commentary style. There's a lot of people that love it. I haven't found too many people that have been in the middle, where they're kind of been indifferent. Either love him or hate him. I personally love him. I know there's a lot of other people out there that love him. This will get a lot of people to tune in to the games that he's on just to hear him. And for me, my game to watch this week is PSG against Juventus on Tuesday on Paramount Plus, with Ray Hudson co-commentating in this game, because, of course, Messi's going to be there. Neymar's going to be playing. Mbappe's going to be playing. So on and so forth. And And also Ray's done a lot of Serie A games too. So I'd love to see if this goes well on the Champions League to have Ray also doing some of the Serie A games, the co-commentary when this spot's available, because I really think he can really enhance the game, enhance the pleasure of viewing the game. And to me, Ray is a romantic. Ray is a person that will paint a picture. You will be seeing a game and he'll be kind of honing in on those coats of paint that are just dazzling. They're just like, oh my gosh, just watch this for the pure beauty of it in slow-mo, and listening to Ray's description of it, it's poetry. And not everyone's going to love it, but I do personally, and there's a lot of other big fans about it too, and I think this is a great hire. And I think Kartik, I think you're right. I think on the press side, on the media side, they almost underplayed this, but in some ways it might be just in terms of not wanting to go ahead and take any of the exposure or kind of the headlines from Kate Abdo and Jamie Carragher and Thierry Henry, etc. But for me, this is a big hire. Losing Peter Drury, though, is a big loss, and it's unfortunate that he's not going to be able to call games for the Champions League, for CBS Sports. And Dre Cordero is okay. He's good. He's not great. He's not one of the best. He's not one of the worst. He's good. And he's getting better. He's improving. But his commentary style is quite different. And I would personally much prefer to hear Peter Drury calling games, not because of the accent, but in terms of how much better of a commentator he is. But Peter Drury has been doing this for a lot longer than Dre Cordero.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, two things. You and I like Ray Hutson so much that I guess it was 12 years ago, because it was right after Dempsey's goal for Fulham against Juventus. You and I went to listen to Ray Hutson read poetry, right? One night, and that was combined with watching the Pallotta film. But it was pretty majestic to have that that night where he read us poetry about Riquelme and Messi and all of these greats. And then, of course, he threw in the Dempsey thing because Deuce had just scored that cracker for Fulham in the Europa League against Juventus. Arguably the biggest goal in Fulham's history, was certainly one of the biggest goals in Fulham's history. The question for you, Chris, is would you prefer to have Peter Drury calling Champions League matches, maybe 12 times a year on CBS, 12, 15 times a year, or would you prefer this arrangement, because I prefer it, where he's on NBC every weekend and we're getting him 70, 75 times a year calling big Premier League matches, or more maybe. Some weekends he's calling, probably two matches a week. So, yeah, like 76 matches a year.
Yeah, no. I prefer having Peter do the actual Premier League. I mean, to me, that's enhanced my pleasure of watching the Premier League this season. It's been a joy to listen to him calling more games, and we get to now hear more of him in the Premier League. In previous seasons, for the last 10 years or so, we've had less of him calling Premier League games, because oftentimes the big games that he would be calling, we wouldn't, for the world feed, it would be Ola White and, I don't know, Graeme Lasseau or somebody else. So we wouldn't get to hear him do as much Premier League matches. However, I would love the best of both worlds, and that would be to have him doing Champions League and the actual Premier League too. But I guess, I mean, it does show in some ways how competitive things are. NBC Sports must have made the decision to say, hey, nope, you can't do CBS Sports coverage of the Champions League. You are a full-time employee of NBC Sports, and we'd rather you not do that Champions League stuff. But the other thing that's interesting about this, Kartik, I think for the first few weeks of this group stage, every single game is on Paramount Plus. There's no games on television on the English language side. What we do get on English language television is the Golasso show, so the Whip Around show, so which for the group stage has... You mean it makes sense in some ways if there's a lot of goals going in, there's so many games happening at the same time. On the Spanish language side, in previous years, we've had a lot of the games on Univision, Unimas, Galavision, Tuduene. This year, most of the games, a large majority of the games, are going to be on VIX Plus, which is their paid streaming service. So that's a big change. Paramount Plus on the English language side, I think a lot of us have gotten accustomed to that. It's cheaper than VIX Plus. I think VIX Plus is $7 a month, and then Paramount Plus is, what, $5 a month? So this will be a big test, I think, for the CBS Sports versus Univision battle. Having said that, though, too, Kartik, I think hiring Dre Cordero and Ray Hudson is going to be appealing to a lot of the bilinguals, kind of the households that speak English and Spanish. And maybe CBS Sports thinks that having Andres Cordero on these calls with Ray Hudson too, and with Ray, of course, I'm sure he's going to be calling a lot of the PSG games and Barcelona games and kind of the European, even whether it's Spanish teams, Italian teams, etc., whether that was part of the decision-making process also.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I've been amazed that CBS's ratings have been so high while the matches are available on Univision. So this maybe cuts into a different demographic for them, a demographic that is watching the Champions League, but on another network. And that also sets up well for the next six. Well, I guess now it's 8 years, right? They have this for eight more seasons. So now that they've got the long runway, which is always a problem with these rights deals in the past when they were on 3 year cycles, they can really begin to hone in on targets in terms of demographics that they might want to shift over gradually to their coverage. So I think this is all very smart and strategic from CBS's point of view.
So what about the evolution of Ray Hudson as a co-commentator? Because when he was coaching in Major League Soccer, he started doing some games for ESPN. Actually, before he was coaching. So before he was coaching in MLS, he was doing games for ESPN at the time. And then he became a coach in MLS, and then that ESPN job, you mean, obviously he couldn't do both. But from there, you mean, he's done Gold TV, like you said, went on to Be In Sports and was really kind of the main person at Be In Sports, then was doing Inter Miami games. But now, to me, this is a big step up for him personally. I mean, CBS Sports, you mean, you can't get much bigger than that.
Yeah, no, you can't. And I think that this is a huge step up. And there have been calls for years for national broadcasters to hire Ray Hudson, right? Literally, since we started doing this show in whatever incarnation in 2006, I believe it was. Maybe it was 2005 with you. I didn't join you until 2006. There have been calls for, why doesn't ESPN hire Ray Hudson? Why doesn't Fox hire Ray Hudson? Why doesn't NBC hire Ray Hudson? Why doesn't Turner hire Ray Hudson? Now CBS has actually come through and done it. So, and I should mention, CBS Sports has a major presence in South Florida. They have a studio and a facility in Fort Lauderdale, so it might be easier for them to get guys like, and Dre Cordero also is from Miami, right? So get guys like Dre Cordero and Ray Hudson into, they're more on the radar for CBS maybe than they are for networks that don't have a major facility in South Florida, although NBC does also. So maybe no excuse on their front. But again, Ray Hudson maybe doesn't fit the Premier League very well. It's more a continental thing. And so yeah. Great move by CBS.
Yeah, I think in many ways, though, to Kartik, this could be another step up for Ray Hudson. Opportunities, maybe if he does well at CBS Sports, maybe, and that might not be an exclusive deal, maybe he can also do some coverage for some of the other broadcasters. But yeah, no, I'm looking forward to watching it. I think one more thing about the Ray Hudson thing is that I think this is a huge plus on the highlight reel. So I can imagine in terms of UEFA Champions League highlights, you mean on television or online or on social media, and you've got Ray Hudson, you mean, explaining a Messi goal or a Neymar goal that would get a lot more plays, a lot more interest than, say, I don't know, no offense, but like Rob Green as a co-commentator, who is going to be one of the CBS Sports' co-commentators with Clive Tildesley. So, yeah, no, I think it's going to be a big plus for CBS Sports, and I'm looking forward to it. Let's move on to Listener Mailbag. Kartik, I think you and I have been watching Welcome to Wrexham. We'll probably do a show entirely on Welcome to Wrexham, our thoughts on this series from FX. Chris says, I briefly wanted to offer my thoughts on Welcome to Wrexham so far. I think it's a well-put-together series, so much so that I have stopped watching Hard Knocks on HBO Max. Unlike Hard Knocks, in my view, this is a true underdog story with just a touch of Hollywood in it. The owners are not the stars of the series. Instead, it's the real-life stories of the players, the town, and staff at Wrexham that makes this series so good. One of the best new series I have watched in recent years. All right, moving on. Let's see. Greg's got some feedback for us about last week's episode, talking about the managers under pressure. We talked about the four managers, and then within 24 hours after that podcast came out, Scotty Parker got sacked. There's three more to go. But anyway, Greg says, the four managers discussion last week got me thinking. Swap them around. Would Brendan Rodgers at Aston Villa do better than Steven Gerrard? Yes. Would Rodgers at Everton do better than Lampard? Maybe. But their issue is getting someone to score. No manager can get the goals out of that front line when DCL is injured, which is often. Would any manager at Leicester be in the same situation? Yes. The club is a mess financially, and the dressing room must be unstable given the captain leaving a week before the season starts and Fofana downing tools. Maybe the dressing room is his doing, or maybe the players can see that ownership is tightening belts. They also don't have a director of football, as they're waiting for that guy from Southampton to finish his gardening leave. Same with Bournemouth. No manager, aside from maybe Big Sam, could keep them up. But does that make you wonder about Scott Parker? He's now been at odds with two successive owners. Maybe it's his bad luck. Maybe it's maybe he's a bit of the pill. Would Steven Gerrard do better than anyone else at the other three clubs? Lampard? I don't know. They don't seem to have much in their managerial toolkit other than, come on, boys, we have to outwork the other team.
And on Scotty Parker, I have to say, we did a Twitter space at the end of the transfer deadline day, and I had a lot of listeners. Some were from the UK. It was crazy. People stayed up, did this at 8 o'clock Eastern time when the window shut, and I had car problems. I still actually have one of my two cars that's not working, that's not starting. So I had to have a mechanic come here, and I missed the last hour of the window and ended up pushing the space back to 8 p.m. Eastern, which is 1 a.m. UK time. There were still people in the UK up wanting to talk transfers who jumped on my space, and while we ended up going through the transfers, when we got to Fulham, the conversation then shifted away from transfers to Scott Parker, and basically Parker should never manage again. And these weren't Fulham fans, by the way. One guy leading the charge was a Chelsea fan. Parker should never manage again because Mitrovic obviously got neutered by Parker. Now in hindsight, Marco Silva, we give him lots of plaudits. I rate Marco Silva pretty highly as a manager, but what did Silva do according to the people on our space? He just realized that he had this great number nine and decided to play to his strengths. So I think Parker's reputation is as much damaged by Fulham post-Parker as it is his stint at Bournemouth, which you and I have talked about since January, right? That Parker was underachieving at Bournemouth. In terms of Lampard, I think he has more in his toolkit than just the rousing speech, although that clearly is a big part of it, right? Because Everton's giving spirited performances. You see what Everton's trying to do tactically, and it makes sense. It's just taking some time with all the new players. In terms of Gerrard, we saw more this weekend, right? Douglas Luiz being inserted in more of a kind of attacking role, more of an 8 than a 6. And maybe even you could argue a little bit of playing a little bit of a 10. No Coutinho, no Buendia in that starting a lineup. Maybe this was to counter Man City, right? But it looked like Villa looked better playing with Luiz in a more central advanced role and with some protection behind him than when Coutinho was there and Luiz is dropped further back and you have McGinn kind of trying to connect the lines between the two of them. So I think that was an improvement. In terms of Brendan Rodgers, I don't know. Leicester is a mess. And the situation with Leicester will be interesting when the new director of football comes in. There was some dissatisfaction at Southampton with the acquisition policy. Southampton had the magic touch for many years with going into the continent, getting guys, and then flipping them. I mean, even guys, you think about guys like Sadio Mane and Gaetano Pella, and some of the guys they brought in from continental clubs were either big hits for them or were sold for massive amounts of money. I mean, obviously, Van Dijk coming in from Celtic also. Now there was some dissatisfaction, and they went ahead and poached a guy from Manchester City who knows the Man City system really well, which is why Southampton has brought in 3 or 4 Man City players, I think 4 Manchester City players over the summer, right? Young players from Manchester City, either on loan or bought them outright with a buyback clause. So how he'll fare at Leicester is anyone's guess, and I think there's also probably some knock-on effect now from the ownership issue, from the owner passing away. His son has run the club. Obviously, they won the FA Cup. They finished 5th 2 successive years, 2 very good seasons in the Premier League under him. But that may have just been a knock-on effect. Now we're seeing the first sustained rebuild under the younger owner, and it's not going very well. So maybe that has a lot to do with what's happening at Leicester as well.
Yeah, definitely ones to keep an eye on in terms of Leicester, Aston Villa, Bournemouth with a comeback victory over the weekend, and those managers still under pressure. I mean, obviously with Bournemouth. You mean it'll be interesting to see if that will continue.
And actually, I should mention Bournemouth. I think that they'd be better off not getting a Big Sam and getting a manager who is willing to play some good football with the team they have, because they have a lot of parts that are left over from Eddie Howe that can play football. I've suggested Chris Wilder. Now, of course, Burrow have started terribly in the championship, but I still think that's a guy that might be able to squeeze 40 points out of this squad just by virtue of the way he sets up his team and the way he plays. Although it can go terribly bad with him, as we saw with Sheffield United the second season in the Premier League, and now with Burrow, because Wilder is not going to sit back and stick 8 men behind the ball at any point. So that it could be risky, but I think maybe not necessarily him, but a manager like him is where I'd go. Maybe Slaven Bilic. That might be the right guy.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next up is Dave. Dave says that the Premier League has a lot of money and prestige right now, and it seems to be only increasing. Will they squander their advantage somehow? It was not that long ago that the Premier League was on the verge of losing the 4th Champions League slot, while nobody outside Spain could beat a Spanish team in the Champions League or the Europa League. I guess you never know what the future holds, but the Premier League is in an enviable position. JP says, all the talk of the Premier League being the de facto Super League is premature. Yes, it's the most popular domestic league in the world. Yes, they spend the most money. That doesn't always mean they have the best teams or most attractive matches. The Premier League has had a large advantage with their television contracts for many, many years already. Some of those years produced poor results in European play. It's all cyclical, as you've said. Just because they spend the most doesn't always equate to spending well. And we saw this with this transfer window in the summer, is the amount of money that was spent in this transfer window by Premier League teams was the same amount of money as La Liga, the Bundesliga, Serie A, and Liga combined. And I think, yeah, definitely in terms of just spending money doesn't mean that's going to equal success. But the sheer amount of players and the money spent, but the sheer amount of quality that's going to these clubs. And it's not just your, I mean, Arsenal's or Man City's or Man United's or Chelsea's, but you also are getting, you mean, whether it's Newcastle United, West Ham United, or other teams throughout the actual league are getting some major, major players, some Brazilian stars that are going to the Premier League, and not just the top four, not to the top four or top six clubs. So you would imagine that that will result in really more domination in Europe. But Europe is a cup competition too, so that there's that factor too, right, Kartik?
Yeah, Europe is a cup competition, and I think anything can happen. And there are certain built-in factors that maybe favor Spanish clubs in particular. I do think that this historically has always been cyclical. Serie A was on top for a long period of time. Maybe younger people don't remember that, but they were the go-to league in the 90s and early 2000s. Spain was on top for a while. We've had fleeting moments where the Premier League has come to the forefront, or the Bundesliga. But now it feels like the cycle might be broken, because the disparity in TV money, and not just TV money, but commercial contracts and sponsorship for individual clubs, for clubs beyond the top clubs in a league, are so skewed. So, for example, while Bayern still draws about as much sponsorship revenue as any club in England, right? You compare hypothetically West Ham or Brighton to similar level clubs in Spain and Germany and Italy, and the sponsorship revenue is off the charts for the English clubs by comparison. Then you throw in the television money. So I think that while the assumption is it's cyclical, and there seems to be some sort of built-in campaign, right? This narrative, almost like a very preachy political campaign that's being created on social media to push back against the notion that English clubs are dominating. Or there are also people saying that there has to be some sort of regulation of English clubs that somehow shouldn't exist for continental clubs, right? There has to be some sort of standard or regulation imposed by UEFA or FIFA to bring English clubs back to the mean towards Spanish and Italian clubs. Even though the fans of Spanish and Italian football, Chris, have never advocated this for Eastern European clubs or clubs from the Low Countries or clubs from Scandinavia, right? When Spanish and Italian clubs have been beating up on those clubs in Europe, it was never a problem. There was never anything wrong with the system. It's only now that they see England's clubs pulling away and the English league pulling away that suddenly there has to be some sort of regulation. I love how that works. But I don't think any of that is going to matter. I actually think the cycle now, Chris, has been broken, and the Premier League is going to pull away. Champions League's a cup competition. Anything can happen. I don't know that it's a really good standard. I mean, maybe it is a standard, but it shouldn't be the only standard for comparing and judging leagues. But I think in just the general overall drift of where top players are going to go, where guys are going to want to play football, it's England. It's the Premier League. And this applies to people from everywhere. The influx of Brazilian players to the Premier League in the last few seasons is pretty significant, Chris, because this is something that always was the missing element in the Premier League, right? There were a lot of top Brazilian players in Italy always, Spain less than Italy. Germany developed, there was a period where there were a lot of the top Brazilian players were going to Germany. Obviously, always been a ton in Portugal. Now you're seeing, I want to say, the majority of Brazil's really elite players, maybe of their top 20 players, the majority of them are now playing in England. It might even be 15 of the 20. I actually should do this and count it up. But if you go position by position in the Brazilian national team and who's going to start, who's going to be the backups in Qatar, I think the majority of them play in the Premier League now.
Yeah, that's always been the discussion in previous years, where we talk to people about the best leagues in the world. And oftentimes it would be a battle discussion, kind of a heated discussion between La Liga versus the Premier League. And on the La Liga side, oftentimes they would say like, well, yeah, but still, you've got the best players in the world don't play in the Premier League. It's Messi playing in Spain. It's Neymar playing in Spain. Those two players in particular have now moved on, of course, to France. However, with the amount of Brazilians coming into the Premier League, I mean, there's the capacity, the potential that the best players in the world, the next generation of the best players in the world, will be playing in the Premier League. So whether it's arguably Erling Haaland, right, or it's, Paqueta, or whatever, whoever these players are going to be, they're going to be the next big superstars. We shall see. Antony, too. I mean, Antony making a great debut for Manchester United. You saw right away the brilliance and the difference in that player.
Paqueta in particular, Paqueta, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I've heard various pronunciations in watching Leon matches. So we'll go whatever the pronunciation is. That in particular, a Brazilian friend of mine WhatsApped me when that move to West Ham happened, said that to him is just confirmation the Premier League is pulling away. And he's been one of these people who said, oh, it's cyclical, yeah, Premier League's on top now, but it'll come back, it'll be Spain or Italy at some point. And he's based in Brazil. He WhatsApped me and said that's it, you know, that's like to him the best Brazilian number 10 of this generation. Who not only has he gone to West Ham, but he's gone to West Ham specifically because he wanted to play in the Premier League. That was the consideration. It's like, I want to be where the best is, and I'm Brazil's best number, at least in this guy's opinion, I'm Brazil's best number 10 of this generation. I want to be where the best are, so I need to find my way to an English club, and if Man City, Man United aren't going to sign me, let me go to the next level, to the level right below that, just so I get myself into the Premier League.
Yeah,
that's a big deal.
And I wouldn't be surprised in a couple of years if he did join Man City or Arsenal or Chelsea or Man United, and then was, you mean, just top drawer, right, in terms of just moving up the ladder. Hopefully he'll do well at West Ham. Hopefully he'll stay there for a long time. But
I think he probably will, because Moyes is one manager, and I explained this to this guy. I'm like, I think the reason he's going to West Ham is Moyes is a manager that still values the use of a number 10, which is kind of now passé. In club football, maybe not at the international level, but in club football, you see teams playing either in a 4-3-3 or a 3-5-2 or some variation of those formations, which doesn't feature a central playmaker. West Ham, throughout Moyes' tenure, and this was the same thing at Everton, always have had that central playmaker, whether it was Timmy Cahill. Recently with West Ham, it's been, he's alternated Lanzini, Benrahma, Fornals, but he favors that central attacking midfield player that a lot of managers are phasing out in their setup. So I think West Ham actually, from a playing perspective, is probably a great fit for him. And he looked pretty tidy in his debut against Chelsea. Obviously, we've talked ad nauseum about VAR in that match, but the match itself was pretty good.
Yeah. Arsenal, Man United game too. A lot of good games this past weekend. And that's the thing. One more thing on this too, Kartik, is that taking the other than the Premier League, the next four top European leagues, and those four European leagues having the same spend as just the Premier League, I think what it may show is in the next few years is maybe a level of desperation in terms of the Barcelonas, Real Madrids, Juventuses of the world going into deeper debt just to try to keep up, just try to get those players, because that is their ticket to success in terms of whether it's the Champions League, sponsorship deals, ticket sales, TV revenue. TV revenue has such a big impact that the fear is that gap is going to extend even further, which is worrying signs for a lot of those big clubs in Europe. Just a couple more comments to go. Rico wants to talk about Anthony Gordon. Rico says, Anthony Gordon is another overhyped English player who doesn't compare to Havertz, Pulisic or Werner, who have produced for bigger clubs and in the Champions League. I disagree with Kartik's assessment, and I agree with Christopher. If Gordon is worth $100 million, then how much is Vinicius Jr. worth? $250 million?
Yeah, I can see that perspective if you're focused solely on the Champions League. But there's a consistency factor you need in the Premier League, which Gordon has shown at Everton, which Havertz has never shown. I don't even know if Havertz is – I would play him very often in the Premier League. I know he got the winner in this match this past week, but he's an inconsistent player. He has runs of form where he looks very good for 3 or 4 weeks and then fades for 6 weeks and then plays well in Europe, so we tend to forget about it. I don't think he's an elite Premier League player at all. I don't think he should be on a top Premier League side. Pulisic has had a lot of injuries. I think there's still some flaws in his game that haven't been worked out, but I think he has more upside than Havertz. Havertz I wouldn't touch, personally, if I were running a football club. And Werner, I like Timo Werner. I think he was underappreciated by fans in England. I think he did a lot of stuff off the ball that the two other players you mentioned, Havertz and Pulisic, don't do. Made a lot of good forward runs, did a lot of things in terms of his movement and drifting into space that enabled other players to do good things for Chelsea in the attack. So, but he again lacked the consistency that I think Gordon has shown, albeit at a club struggling. But Gordon has been consistently good, I would say, since last December, since before Benitez got sacked. He's been consistently good through this point. I don't think Havertz, Pulisic, or Werner ever had a run of that long where they were consistently good in their play in the league, particularly Havertz. Again, I would go back to Havertz and say he's a flash in the pan. He's the type of guy who should be a reserve maybe on a continental club that's competing in Europe that you throw on for the last 30 minutes of a Champions League match. Maybe he'd be good at Real Madrid in that role, but I do not think he's consistent enough to be a starter in the Premier League for a top club.
Last but not least, Ryan Evans says, I really wanted to get your guys' thoughts on the Alex Neil situation. I still don't know what happened to him and Sunderland. Judging from the contract he had, it seemed like he was never planning to stay long-term with Sunderland and jumped at the first opportunity he got to leave. Also, Champions League chances for Celtic and Rangers. Rangers worry me a bit because of their inconsistency. Celtic, I think, are going to be very good and at least make it out of the group stage. The man I dubbed King Kyogo, because he's the king of the Scottish Premiership, I think will show the world that he isn't just the big fish in the small pond, but a world stage superstar. So, Kartik, I'll tackle Celtic and Rangers first. Kyogo, I've watched over the past year. And for Celtic, what an exceptional player, really, really good Japanese player. The Old Firm Derby, which is this past weekend, he got injured within the first couple of minutes, kind of a nasty blow to the shoulder. Hopefully he'll be fine for the game against Real Madrid. And that's the thing, though, too. I mean, like, you know, going from the Celtic Rangers game, which is, you know, a big game, massive game, fun to watch. But the level of football between that and then playing Real Madrid, we'll see in terms of Celtics and Rangers chances. I favor Celtic more in terms of their chances, but I'd like to see them get out of the group stage, but I'm not optimistic there. And Rangers are too inconsistent. It's just you never know which one's going to turn up. And they can be good, such as in the Europa League, but then they can also be pretty poor, as we've seen. What about Sunderland with the situation there, Kartik?
Yeah, first off, I have to say Alex Neil going to Stoke wasn't that much of a shock to me. Stoke has been in this position where they have consistently poached managers since they've gone down, right? They've consistently poached managers that have been, they thought, the next big thing that can get them to back to the Premier League. They did it with Nathan Jones, who has been very good, except when he was at Stoke. Michael O'Neill, now Alex Neil. Now, unfortunately, though, this is reflecting more on Sunderland, right? And I think you have a situation where Sunderland is not a stable enough situation. And Neil, they went unbeaten, right, from February onward last year in League One to get out of the league. But you have a situation where I think the consensus is that this is a lateral move for Neil. So why would he make it? Well, they are clear. The reasons are pretty clear, in my opinion. I think they are in a situation where you're looking at Sunderland potentially having maybe another they're not as chaotic a club as they were when, for example, the Netflix documentary happened. But I think there is a certain lack of stability in that club, and there is an inability for the club to go out and get the kind of players that that he wanted, in addition to the fact that he was on a rolling contract, right? Which is the point you make, right, Ryan? The rolling contract was bizarre, and the rolling contract to me indicates there's still some backroom dysfunction at Sunderland. And the terms of his contract apparently had been improved since over the summer after they were promoted, but it was then not until Stoke and some other clubs, I should mention, from what I'm told, were sniffing around Alex Neil, that Sunderland's board came back to Neil and offered a more concrete contract proposal. Now, if it takes other clubs sniffing around to poach your manager for that to happen, maybe you really are at the wrong club. And Alex Neil is a wanted guy. He got Sunderland out of League One. He got Norwich out of the Championship, remember, and played some nice football in the process. He's a pretty good manager and still a young manager that's improving in each job. If I'm him, I walk, and that's what he did.
All right, listeners, if you want to share any feedback that you have about anything we've discussed on the show, if you have any questions in regards to what we've talked about, or questions about streaming or television or Ray Hudson, whatever it may be, definitely share them with us. We'd love to read those out on air. You can reach us via email, which is web@worldsoccertalk.com. And then we've got facebook.com/worldsoccertalk. You can leave us a message there, as well as Twitter @worldsoccertalk. And let me think of any other places. Of course, the website, worldsoccertalk.com, the podcast thread there. You can leave it in the comments section. And then last but not least, we also have audio voicemail. So you can leave an audio voicemail, which the phone number to call to leave an audio voicemail is 561-247-4625. All right, Kartik can be reached on Twitter @KKFLA737 for, you know, sometimes Twitter spaces, sometimes politics, sometimes Florida history, and definitely a lot of soccer there. I can be reached @TheGaffer or on the main Twitter thread, which is @WorldSoccerTalk. So thank you for listening. We've got a great week of football coming up. And Kartik, what are you going to do, and what should the listeners do?
Enjoy your football.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.